Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and Tina Patterson. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Cassie, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Yes,
appreciate it.
Yes. We've had this scheduled for a while. We finally, you know, the stars aligned and we were able to do this. Now, I'm going to talk. Well, let me give you an intro. Let me tell the audience about you a little bit. And then I want to talk about what we were taught the last time we talked, because it's an exciting story. But Tina Patterson, for anyone who doesn't know, she's an ADR professional. And I met you at the Academy of Court-Appointed Neutrals meeting 2 years ago. And I remember we didn't formally meet, and we were at the end of the session, the end of the annual meeting, and we were talking about changing the name and getting the ABA to change the model rules to refer to special masters as court-appointed neutrals. And this was a huge effort. You know, I'm behind it. I know you are. And there was a lot of very particular conversations about how exactly we want to propose language to ABA and really wordsmithing in a group meeting. It was fascinating. And I just remember, like, you were piping in with some very, like, thoughtful ways to craft the language. And I was like, I've got to meet her. I need to know her. And it was literally the last session, I think, of the day. And I was like, we need to connect after this meeting. And we did. And here we are. So Tina, I'm so glad you're here. You're just like a bright star in the world of ADR. So
thank you.
I'd love for you to tell the audience a little bit more about, you know, your background before we dip into all the other fun stuff.
Certainly. Cassie, I forgot about that meeting at the Academy of Court-Appointed Neutrals. But as you mentioned it, I do recall we were on the screen was some language that was being proposed. And I should say, as a language and linguistics major undergrad and constantly writing and editing, that I went into that mode. So the commas and what word should come first and parallelism. Yes, all of that. So by way of background, I started out, you mentioned being involved with AI and machine language. I think my experience with technology, specifically computer technology and software development and early efforts of artificial intelligence goes back at least 25 years. I started out in travel technology. I started out in installations. For some of your audience, that what I'm about to say will probably predate them, but I used to carry with me an ohm meter and a book that allowed me to cable wires, put together the pen heads for the printers and the computers, IBM Model 30s and 70s. I would meet the technician from either one of the baby Bells, Bell South or Bell Atlantic, and we would go to the telco drop, and I would drop my line and run it to the main point in that office and then do some other wiring and schematics. And I used to carry my tool set with me on the plane, and it would go through security. So again, long, long time ago, I worked for a company where we actually transitioned. Travel was probably one of the forerunners in the use of early artificial intelligence. And we went from using what was called a green screen, basically a green lettering and a black background, to graphical user interface, which is still commonly used today, to some of a combination of images as well as this still using the graphics. So the person that you see that's supposedly walking on the plane or the person that you see that's on a cruise, the company I worked for did a lot of that early work. So I'm not a stranger to artificial intelligence. I'm not a stranger to the use of data and the good sides and what I call the shadow side. But I also, in 2001, transitioned I expanded my skill set to include alternative dispute resolution. I actually fell into alternative dispute resolution quite by accident. I thought I was going to become a Foreign Service officer and began preparing for that journey. I enrolled in a program for alternative dispute resolution, thinking it would make me a strong candidate. I completed, at that time, a certificate program that was offered by Southern Methodist University. Completed the program, did not become a Foreign Service officer, but my mediation instructor and my arbitration instructor approached me and said, have you thought about being an arbitrator? Have you thought about being a mediator? And the rest is history. So I've been in this space now about 23 years. It continues to fascinate me. I am not a lawyer, but I have been in the space, and I know people often say you have to be a lawyer. That is not true. I am living proof that non-lawyers do exist, and we thrive in this sector.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the Academy of Court Appointed Neutrals is similar. There are a lot of ADR professionals who are members of Academy of Court Appointed Neutrals. You don't have to be an attorney to be appointed by the judiciary to be that extra, you know, pair of hands to help whatever need that they have. So I think it's an excellent point. It's absolutely necessary for a legal ecosystem to have a broad group of people. Now, are you seeing like these conversations about AI? And we're going to talk about this here in a little bit about AI and ADR, maybe specifically. Does it feel like your life is coming full circle now, kind of seeing conversations about AI being so present in our profession?
It does. It does. It's interesting because when I did work in computer technology, and I should be transparent, I still work with clients now, mostly on the government contracting side, that are putting together software systems and artificial intelligence. This conversation regarding AI has literally mushroomed within the past 2 to 3 years. And a lot of it has to do with the pace in which we see artificial intelligence being used. And it does feel full circle. I frequently tell colleagues, I look at the advent and growth of artificial intelligence as we see it today, much like the rollout of a product. There are those early adopters who are on board, they're using whatever's come out in the market, they're trying it, they're testing it. And then we have the laggards who are saying, I like things the way they were before. Why do I need fill in the blank, whether that's ChatGPT or DALL-E or other tools? And there are those in that latter group who are literally saying, I don't want this as part of my mediation. I don't want this as part of my arbitration. How do I stop this? And that's the conversation that's a little bit more difficult because I don't foresee it stopping. Actually, I would prefer, and I've taken on this position, I like to think of the use of artificial intelligence for alternative dispute resolution in two ways. One, increasing the efficiency of me as a practitioner, increasing the efficiency of the process for the parties and for me, but also increasing the opportunity for access to justice. And that conversation, each of those conversations has a different lens, but it still involves me, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a tool that we can use. And absolutely. I think, you know, some of the hesitation of some people, I think it is a bit of an emotional response, you know, maybe not feeling comfortable with the technology or with maybe the status quo changing. Of course, there are legitimate concerns about risk and around confidentiality or privilege waiver, all of which needs to be taken seriously, but they're not insurmountable risks that have to be assessed. They're legitimate risks, but they're capable of being addressed, and these tools are capable of being used. And similarly, you would still expect people to validate the results. I think there are some, you know, unfortunate uses of AI that have been used as the poster child of why you shouldn't use it, but really it's an example of maybe they are also deficient in not overseeing other elements of their work product. And it's just being really highlighted right now because it's in the news. Let's talk about ADR, like alternate dispute resolution. It's similar to litigation in some ways, but it's got its own procedural vibe, its own process. But still, to your point, it is a conversation about access to justice. How do you see AI being a tool of good for ADR professionals?
Certainly. So I will say this. Generally, when I talk to the public regarding alternative dispute resolution, I talk about the continuum of alternative dispute resolution and the involvement of the parties, with mediation being having the opportunity or setting the stage for the parties to be as involved as possible to litigation, which is where they're not involved. They literally are either relying on the judge or a jury to make the determination. And arbitration is between the full engagement of the parties in making that decision and a third party. Where I see AI being very beneficial is literally in the process of handling the documentation that comes in. A lot of my work is in the space of arbitration, so I'll start there. When I think about using artificial intelligence, I think about it in the sense of when briefs are submitted to me, and sometimes I get 6 or 7 briefs that are anywhere from 20 to several hundred pages. And it's the expectation is that I will read them, that I will be knowledgeable about those briefs before going in. Now, depending on what's in my docket, that's time consuming. If I can have that AI tool literally provide me a summary, that's a time savings for me, but it's also a time savings for the parties. I also like using AI, and this has come up a couple of times, where parties have sent me briefs and they have focused on a particular paragraph and a precedent that they want me to look at. And it seems like it fits, but I've actually said, I've used an AI tool, in this case it was DALL-E, and I said, go and look at this, tell me about this, and this particular, give me a summation of what's going on here, but also the paragraph before and the paragraph following this particular sentence or group of sentences. Most of the time, it's accurate, but there's times when what's being focused on isn't really what the issue is that's being brought before me. Now, does that mean I suddenly have a specific opinion? No, but as far as the precedent that's being presented, I now see there isn't necessarily a precedent, and I can give it its due weight when I'm rendering the decision. I also, and I have had colleagues talk about this, I don't want AI used. Well, that's going to be difficult because some of the more basic uses of AI are things like LexisNexis, or if you want to get very basic, it's the predictive text that we see in Word.
Right.
So I think the bigger question is asking, if you were presenting briefs to me that were generated using artificial intelligence, what is the source that you used? Did you use a reputable source? And I will say this, I have no monetary involvement with the organization I'm about to mention or the application. I like Perplexity AI. And I like Perplexity because when something is referenced or when it does a search, you see the citations and the citations are searchable and you can make the determination, is this a worthwhile citation or is this literally an extrapolation? And if it doesn't make sense, don't want to use it. For parties, and this is where I have a challenge, when parties want to bring their AI into the arbitration or the mediation, especially when it's online, I don't allow Otter, I don't allow other systems that are similar into my arbitration. I don't allow it into the mediation unless the parties are on board with it. I generally, it's not that I'm not comfortable, but the extent on which that data is captured and where it's being stored and who has access to it is still unfolding. And so I generally say, proceed with caution if you're going to do this in mediation. But you have to let the other party know. In arbitration, I say absolutely no. And we are seeing more of this. I know recently with the conversation with Copilot and Microsoft, Otter was already saying, we do this, but now they're more transparent about it. Otter can come into a room, take images of individuals, transcribe, but also provide additional information. And if this is supposed to be a confidential matter, it shouldn't be shared. So Those are some of the ways I see AI being used. I think it's an absolutely wonderful tool. I love the fact, and again, I'm going to talk about the basic sides of AI so that people aren't just thinking, oh, it's just ChatGPT. It's just this. It's literally, if you are trying to render an image or you want me to understand that you're talking about something that is complex and you want me to see the image, by all means, a picture's worth 1,000 words. If you can show me that with an AI-generated image, I would suggest you do so versus having me or my colleagues, if I'm on a panel, trying to sort it out. So those are some of the instances in which I see very positive use of artificial intelligence, not to mention with the advent of artificial intelligence being more widely used in alternative dispute resolution. I see some of the lengthy and time extended periods shortening. And it's one of the things, especially in consumer arbitration, that the parties are generally concerned about. How long is this going to take? And if it can increase an efficiency in the process, I'm all for it.
Right. There are a few things I want to touch back on things you said. So first is a comment. So the comment about how you used DALL-E or GPT to assess that reference, that citation, I think the way you described it, like the prompt that you gave it, it really highlights the power of thoughtful prompt engineering instead of like just a general, hey, give me a summary or blah, blah, blah. You being really more specific about what you wanted it to drill into, like you're going to get a better result. So I think that's a great highlight for the audience. And this is where just using the tool and playing around with it, I think is in your personal practice to get the feel of how you can maximize the use is really important. The other thing, and this might be the most important thing we talk about in this call, Tina, the GPT or the generative AI tools that are sometimes an app add-on or a web browser extension like Otter that does transcription services or more in meetings, people need to be more aware of that because some of them are very obvious. They'll dial in. The app will dial in as another user. I think Otter does that. But there are some Chrome browser extensions or web browser extensions that they don't disclose to the parties that it's listening in and making a transcript. And depending on what state you're in, there may be some concern, like some states require dual author or mutual consent to recording. So there's that issue. And then the other issue is, if it's a confidential proceeding, which it should be, it's an arbitration mediation, where is that data? Where's that transcript being saved? And probably if it's a web browser extension, it's not being saved in a secure private little slice of your own AWS. So then you've got confidentiality issues. So I think people may see those tools just like, wow, that adds so much convenience to my life. But like being aware, A, as a consumer, that there are some real risks there. And then B, as kind of the organizer of events, like proactively, like, and you really feel like you have to proactively say, if anyone's using this type of transcription tool that is not apparent to me, you can't use it because those tools are available. So it's really like changing like how we have to, things we have to be aware of, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in the past, I would ask, is there someone else in the room? And I know that there was a decision, an overturn of an arbitration decision because the person was being coached by somebody who was sending text messages. This is no different in terms of asking who else is in the room or what else is in the room, and that who could be a person, but that who could also be your AI, your bot that you brought into the room, and disclosing that and literally asking, are you using any tools to record? Many of the arbitrations that I do that are online are recorded, and that recording is available to the parties, but it is not a third party application that someone has brought in. Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. Your comment makes me think about the old saying that we had, garbage in, garbage out. So if you ask a question of a bot of any system, whether you write it or you speak it, and it's not specific, you're going to get a non-specific answer or a generic answer. But the more specific you are, the better in terms of the output. And I think, again, it's trial and error. And especially when you are literally trying to be effective and efficient in that analysis, you want as specific answer as possible, because the parties are relying on you to literally render a decision based on what's been presented. And in the case of mediation, you're helping the parties come to a determination of rendering a decision or coming up with an agreement. So having access to the most accurate information is vitally important.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we often think of garbage in, garbage out just from a data quality issue, but you're right. It also comes into the subject matter expert, the human in the loop, deriving that in there.
Absolutely.
They don't understand the subject matter they're supposed to be an expert of, or they don't effectively craft inputs. You're not going to get the best output.
I think the other thing we're going to see, though, Cassie, and I know I was at a meeting and there were people in the room who were dismayed to see, especially the graphical generative AI, that it was still navigating the spelling of words. And I compare it to a child. So as the child's vocabulary, or in the case of the AI, as its lexicon grows, it will understand the nuances, especially in languages like English, where not everything that is written in a word is actually spoken. So using the example of night and knowing the context of when to use which spelling, I think we're going to see that rapidly change, and we're going to see less of those what we call currently call errors. I think it's lexicon growing. And I think we'll see that in the ADR space as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And you mentioned kind of evidence or demonstrative in reference to an image. I feel like the potential of generative AI in demonstratives in ADR and in trial, I think there's great potential there where you can maybe more effectively share your position to neutral decision maker more effectively. It's like going from whiteboard, literal whiteboards, to graphic design. I think that they're, from that perspective, it's going to be very powerful, or even from the perspective of mediation prep or something like that. What you can do to help prepare for it, the individual parties, I think that there's a lot of power there. Like, I envision one day, like, hologrammed evidence, like demonstrative evidence. I don't know, maybe it'll never happen, but like, it would be very compelling. In a murder or something like that, and like the parties can mock up maybe how they envision the thing happening, like the impact of that, especially if they're able to model it off of individuals with sufficient consent granted if it's needed. So
Cassie, this will blow your mind. I will share this with you. I am a graduate of the FBI Citizens Academy, and what you are talking about does happen today. And so, while we're not talking about ADR, you can rebuild, they can rebuild a scene, and they can do it based on various pieces of evidence. You could actually rebuild a body using sometimes the skull, the teeth. So yes, it's entirely possible. And the 3D modeling occurs today.
Yeah. It's just taking it that one step further, right?
Yes,
like,
ma'am.
Really making it like more present for, I just see that happening. The closer you can get the audience, the jury or the judge to the evidence, I think the more compelling it can be.
Absolutely.
Oh,
that moment of chills,
no,
but yes, it does happen. I think we're going to see it and more. And I'm not in aerospace, but I think in the technology space, we're going to see that, especially when we're talking about things involving trade secrets, or does that schematic look exactly like the other party's schematic?
Mm.
And they can point and say, here, look at this. And you literally see that 3D image appear. Or they can literally drill in and say, here's where the difference lies, or there is no difference. So, yes.
Yeah, it's more compelling than just a graph on a piece of paper, right?
Absolutely.
Or on a big TV screen or whatever. So I think, I just think there's a lot of ways that it can make you a more persuasive. We're thinking a lot about the negatives, and the negatives are legitimate, but again, they're not insurmountable. But now I know that you went through that program at FBI. That's so exciting.
I did.
Tina.
I'm a graduate of the FBI Baltimore chapter, but there's chapters throughout the United States. I'm happy to talk about it, but I won't go into it
exciting.
With you.
That is crazy. So, let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned before, that you are the power of generative AI, at least as we see it now. It's really in your ability to craft instructions. And so I imagine for linguists like yourself, we talked about like how I was wowed in your ability to advise on drafting in the context of ABA policy, but it probably is a great powerhouse for leveraging AI or even analyzing or maybe advising or consulting on AI systems, that linguist background. Are you finding that that's the case, Tina?
I have not found it to be the case for me, but I think the space is there. And there is a divided community on this topic because most of the AI systems that we see rely on English. And I have asked about one, Cyrillic languages, and languages in which the Roman alphabet is not used. And that is still a frontier to be explored. Part of it is the nuance and context. When we typically think of, and I'll use Amharic, Russian, Chinese, these are languages that are not using Roman alphabet in their native language. And there's a lot of controversy about making sure that artificial intelligence recognizes or understands the context and the nuance. Arabic is another. I'm actually working with my language instructor on Arabic, and she keeps reminding me, when we combine the vowels and consonants, that the sound changes. And learning that nuance is something I think is still another frontier. And you're absolutely right. Understanding the structure of the data, especially in the context of English versus in another language, and why it may be structured the way it is. So that's still yet to be explored. I think it's part of the larger conversation that people often have about artificial intelligence being biased. But I will say this, it's not the application that's biased. It is what we are seeing in the data that shows the biases that we have. And so there are some biases in English.
Yeah, I actually was reading an article about this where some scientists have tested out, and it seems like it's like LLMs think in English. So if they get a request in another language, they still transform it into English, analyze it, prepare the output, and then transform it back to the originating language. So, and I've even heard some people, I said this before hearing someone else say it, but I kind of agree with it. AI in some ways is like the modern era of colonialism because it is so heavily reliant and built upon the English language. And so much of our culture is tied to our language. And so what are we doing? We talk about diverse language, and we often think about it kind of like as a vague concept, diversity, but really making sure that the languages and the cultures are being protected, because if that is going to be the mechanism, we've already seen some providers playing around with replacing traditional search engine capabilities with LLMs. If we're going to start heavily relying on that, that has like such a transform your input and gives you an output. If it's so heavily reliant upon English, we'll just culturally, globally start thinking in English, and that's not right. There's a lot of so much precious culture that could get lost. And what do we do to protect that?
So interesting you would say that. Like, two resources come to mind. The first one is the World Intellectual Property Organization has been exploring AI and using AI to represent and to preserve culture. I'm not sure if you are aware of a woman by the name of Temnit Gebru. So Temnit, and I should call her Dr. Temnit, is literally leading an effort where African nations are looking at using AI, one, that uses the local language, but two, preserves the culture along with the language. So there are efforts underway. We don't hear about them as much. I think more conversation has to happen. Mm-hmm. The concept of English being a universal language is fairly recent. When I first got into the space, French was the language. French was considered the universal language, or the language for diplomacy. Now it's English. But along with that, as you're saying, that wiping away of other languages and cultures, or that forgetfulness, is something that we can't do. English in and of itself is a language of cognates, meaning words from other languages that have been borrowed and oftentimes reused in their original state, but sometimes repurposed. And I think we sometimes forget that. This idea of translating word for word, and people will tell you whether it's French or Spanish, Portuguese, Arabic, translating word for word can be problematic because you miss the nuance. And I think AI, if it is doing that, will eventually have to understand the nuance of why the words are in the sequence that they are in, or why a certain word was used versus another word. To me, it's fascinating. It is truly fascinating.
It is. And I think you bring up a really great point. There's two sides of a coin here in this conversation. One is, what can we do to ensure that these foundational models are not blind to ensuring that there's a broad diversity in other languages, or like making sure there are resources for those local communities to build out their own so they can have like their own culturally aligned tools if they want to use them. And then I think on the flip side, it may, like, these tools may be a great mechanism, to your point, to maybe preserve languages that are becoming, you know, extinct. Whenever I was in England last week with my family, we hopped over to Wales just really quickly because we were so close to it. And they're very, very keen on encouraging more Welsh speakers. And I kind of did a deep dive. They're trying to get their student, I think, 1 million Welsh speakers by 2050 or something like that. And they are actively making efforts to ensure that their language is part of the broader AI LLM ecosystem, because it came so close to becoming extinct that they've really forced and created some resources to protect the language. And so they were kind of ahead of the ball. And I think we may see other countries like, or groups like the Maori in New Zealand, where the language is considered a treasure, and even data privacy is considered a treasure. And that's an important thing for the Maori, because that is a protected right that they have because of the UN making a decision that the treaty that they entered into with England, there was a difference in languages in English versus Maori version. So the interpretation has to favor the Maori version. And whenever they entered into a treaty with the Maori, the English, it gave them the right to protect their treasures. And so they've really, like, in the past 50 years or so, made a huge effort to really expand and push the limit of what a treasure is. And I would assume the language is a treasure. And so that's another language that was nearly extinct. And they put a lot of resources into protecting it and really uplifting and refocusing the country's culture on the Maori heritage and not just like the anglicized version of it. It's all really kind of exciting stuff. So I think that's a great point. Like, I didn't know that about the Welsh until I started digging into it. So I think maybe it's similar to like women in tech. Like, I think there are women in tech, they're just not getting the attention that men are getting. And I think that that's the same thing. There are other groups really working at trying to protect these groups and languages. So don't lose hope. Like, people are out there working really hard, right, Tina? Like, that's maybe a takeaway.
Exactly. And for the sociolinguistics that are out there who literally have been fighting to maintain languages that are either dying or have become extinct, I think that AI may prove to be a useful tool in recording the voice cloning of someone who is a speaker of that language to talk about, this is how this language was spoken, this is how it was used, and here's the roots. And we see that today in these other languages, that here are the offshoots, or here's where it still exists today, even if it's on a smaller scale.
Right. Yeah. Just like that preservation, it does create a great opportunity. So many things, AI for good or not bad. I mean, we have to look at both sides of that. We're getting close to the end. I know we could talk all day, Tina. So you live in Maryland, so you're close to the hub of a lot of AI activity. What are you hearing or seeing that gets you most excited? Because I do feel probably are like an insider on some things.
That's a good way of describing it. So I think I try to bridge both worlds. I bridge the private sector and I bridge into the federal sector. So I see both the National Institute for Standards and Technology and its efforts to promote this public facing. And then I see the other side, which is artificial intelligence as a national security issue and those efforts that are underway. So I see sometimes where they're aligned and sometimes where there is a gap, and that gap is intentional. Even when we think about this being a presidential year, presidential election year, the public facing is very, yes, let's do this, versus the Federal Election Commission and other agencies saying, How do we make sure that image that you're seeing, is it really Cassie and Tina, or is mm-hmm. it images that have been generated using AI? Is it voice cloning? And what message is it sending? Am I telling you to go to a polling location that doesn't exist? Am I telling you to send money to an account that really doesn't exist? So yes, seeing that and seeing how it literally is becoming more of a conversation, more of the, okay, ladies and gentlemen, instead of the trust but verify, we're now telling you verify everything.
Yeah. I think that's how we're going to have to go. You know, NIST recently, they published 4 reports recently that build on the AI risk management framework as part of their action items from President Biden's executive order. And one of them was about synthetic data. And then California, I know, is trying to, California's state legislature is trying to pass a law about verifying generative AI is quote unquote fake via watermarks. And if it's real, then it's quote unquote real. And social media platforms have to display the result of that watermark, which is great, but bad actors aren't going to make sure their output has a watermark. They're going to try and get around it. So I think we nearly are going to have to get to platforms that verify something as authentic, and then the consumer is just going to have to get used to that's going to be a social or an online platform that doesn't verify. Maybe I won't do it. Maybe I have to pay a premium to ensure that whatever is on this other version is all authenticated. I think we're going to, because there's no way we can really control it. There is it is a game of whack-a-mole. I think the concept of watermark, like, we have to do something. We have to move in some direction, but we have to know that the bad actors are going to circumvent that. And so we have to prepare for it.
Absolutely. And I agree with everything that you said. Where I see, as someone who is close to both sectors, is the need for the rapid response. Because as mm-hmm. you indicated, while we're having conversations regarding watermarks, is this watermark acceptable? And it's happening at the state and federal level. Bad actors are moving. They're moving at the speed of light. And I'm a Star Trek person, so I'll say this. Think of it as the Borg that's constantly reconfiguring itself as mm-hmm. it meets its opponent. And we're still using, let's use our Lego. Nothing against Lego. But in the meantime, this has transformed 4 or 5 different times and is mm-hmm. getting in. The beauty of AI is the opportunity and the efficiencies. The danger is we still have to talk about cybersecurity. We have to talk about threats. We have to talk about how that data, whose hands that data ends in, and literally melding that all together. I'm hoping that the future will be more of a collaborative conversation mm-hmm. regarding the technologists, but also those who are in the cyberspace saying, here's what cyber defense means. And it's rapid. It's quick. We don't have to recreate the wheel. I will say this, NIST knows that on the Department of Defense side, there's already risk management frameworks in place. Why not borrow? Don't restart.
No, that's a good point. And, you know, I think what makes it especially important, we talk about big things about elections and politicians, and that's all very important, of course. But the impact of minors and female minors to some Absolutely. Of these tools, and what could that potentially do to a generation of young women if they feel like they're being targeted by these generative AI tools out there that can create non-consensual synthetic versions of them in compromising situations, and what that could do to dim their light some, and what generationally that could do to us. I think we can't underestimate that. And mm-hmm. what can we do to protect them and not let that happen? So there's a lot that we have to try and figure out in a short amount of time. So
my question for you, having said that, is it guardrails or guidelines?
I nearly feel like with some of those, especially like the deepfake content that is geared towards like porn, that like that is probably, you have no good intention there. I nearly feel like it has to be guardrail. Like I because the victims are not going to want to come through and prosecute. It's so embarrassing, that just so much of it. And the thought of it being like a teenage, can you imagine going through high school and having to deal with that, or even middle school in some instances? Yeah. I just don't think that can be underestimated, like the harm that could happen there. And it's all available now. Like it could be out there. And parents probably don't even know about it. I think that that's something that should be looked at very firmly, very quickly and addressed in some way, because I mean, it would make me just want to like die inside if something as a teenager or something like that happened to me. There's a lot of like hypotheticals and we talk about it. Like that's true harm that's happening again to minors, and that long-term harm that could come from that, like we can't underestimate that. So I agree. Like we just got to get going. We got to test it out and see what we can do. So what do you think? Guardrails or?
I'm going to take the middle of the road, both. I think there are times when guardrails are important, as you indicated, but I think there's times when guidelines, and when we're talking about parental control and access, guidelines are very much important. But the mm-hmm. guardrails literally need to be flexible enough so that they can change. Mm-hmm. This is not the time when we need to have very prescriptive guardrails that aren't flexible to what's happening in the market and what the appetite is from the consumers. And the consumers could be anyone. I think that's going to be the key moving forward is that flexibility. So I would say both. I know that specific answer, but both.
Like a typical alternative dispute resolution professional, I feel like that's very appropriate. I have to say, like going back to ACAN, one thing I love about ACAN is I'm usually going to conferences with litigation or e-discovery, and ACAN was like a breath of fresh air because I don't know if it's the influence of so many members being ADR professionals, but it was so egalitarian. Okay, let's take notes. Let's get feedback from everybody in the room and let's really consider it. And it was so refreshing to kind of be part of that. I love that. So, and it let me meet you. So there's that as well.
Oh, likewise. likewise. Oh, Cassie, thank you for having me. I've appreciated it. I know we've talked about a lot of different topics. And like you said, we could literally go on.
Go on and on. Yeah, I agree. You know, we'll probably have a part two at some point. A lot of things to talk about. So, well, Tina, thank you so much for joining today. I know learned a lot. And I know the audience will too. And to the audience, thank you so much for joining this episode of Cassie. And stick around for the next episode of Cassie and...